Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on Monday afternoon, the beginning of a brand new week. And I know most of you are weary, bleary-eyed because you stayed up last night to the bitter end of the Academy Awards. I didn't. Did
not
you,
me. No. I'm far too old for that.
Everybody is around this table is shaking their heads. No, we didn't do that. But welcome to Political Rewind today. I'm joined, as I always am on Mondays and Fridays, by my colleague Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. His column appears in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays, and he oversees the Political Insider blog.
Good afternoon. It's good Monday afternoon after a DNC weekend.
That's right. We're going to get to that a little bit later in the show. The Democratic National Committee here all weekend, where they picked their new party chairman, Tom Perez. And we'll talk about that a little later in the show. But before we do that, we want to talk to two very special guests who we've asked to come into the studio today. Dave Baker is the director of the Georgia Faith and Freedom Coalition, the organization founded years ago by Ralph Reed. How long ago did Ralph found that organization, Dave? Do you remember?
We started in 2009. Bill, and thanks for having me on today.
Okay. I'm glad to have you here. Thank you very much. And Jeff Graham, who is the head of Georgia Equality and has been working in this field. You've been doing this a long time, Jeff.
I sure have. Thanks, Bill.
Well, say more. What does that mean?
I actually have been doing it in one form or fashion here in Georgia for almost 30 years.
So, Jim, one of the reasons that the main reason that we asked Dave and Jeff to come in is we thought we should take a deeper dive into the ruling, the executive order by the White House, by President Trump a week or so ago, in which he overturned an Obama administration rule.
A letter of guidance.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you for that clarification. A guideline, but a guideline that came with a veiled threat of a disruption of federal funding if schools across country didn't go along.
Right,
what did
yes.
President Obama want them to do?
Basically, the letter outlined how transgender students should be treated, that they should be able to go to the locker room or the bathroom of their choice. I don't know whether it addressed the practice that you see in some high schools right now of neutral bathrooms, of single place bathrooms. But it, you know, and it addressed, I think, everything from football to, athletic activities to locker room treatment to bathrooms.
And we should point out that that guidance from the White House came after our neighbors up in North Carolina had passed a bill.
Right. It was kind of an answer to that. And we should also note that I believe that it is in abeyance right now, the result of a lawsuit in Texas.
All right. So with that in mind, last week the Trump administration said, no, this is not a federal government issue. This is an issue that should be decided by each state individually, and they rescinded the guideline from the Trump administration.
Right, and it was something of a reversal, because Trump at least had sent out some signals that that he was comfortable with transgender people. That Caitlin Jennings would be welcome.
Jenner was welcome
to use any bathroom she chose in Trump Tower.
All right, so we want to dig into this a bit right now, because the question is, start with you, Jeff Graham. And by the way, we want you to join this conversation. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Some of you already are starting. So let us know what you think about this as we continue our conversation. Jeff Graham, what is your sense of what the implications of the Trump administration's action going to have? What's going to happen?
Sure. Well, you know, as Jim has already said, it really was guidance. It was not binding. Our position on this is that, frankly, Title IX, which protects students against sex discrimination, still exists. And that Title IX, sex discrimination, does include gender identity. There have been a number of legal cases on this over the years. The Department of Education actually did original guidance on this back in 2014. It was last year that the Obama administration did solidify that guidance. And you know, we looked at it a little bit differently than some groups. We felt that it was just guidance and that it was basically a warning that certainly if schools did not follow the guidance, that they were open to lawsuits. If there were lawsuits, they would also be open potentially to losing federal funding.
So your suggestion is that that guidance was based on the White House saying to schools, you may be in violation of Title IX and therefore lose your funding. This was not, because it was a guidance, this was not establishing separate law. White House was saying, you may be violating Title IX.
Yeah, this is all around Title IX. And frankly, you know, this is headed to the Supreme Court at the end of next month with the case of Gavin Grimm out of Virginia. And so the Supreme Court is actually going to be ruling on this, we believe, this year, probably late June is when that ruling will come out. We'll have oral arguments. They're set right now for March 28th. This conversation will be ongoing.
So
basically, what the Trump administration did, though, was say that very clearly that they were no longer going to be enforcing this. And that's what's problematic to us is the statement that that makes to the LGBT community as a whole, but very specifically to transgender youth, that going from a president that clearly had their back to a president who has now said it's going to be left up to educators, lawmakers, policy folks on the state and local level.
So, Dave, it's not surprising that Georgia Equality wished this had not, the Trump administration hadn't taken this position. It's also not surprising that you at Faith and Freedom Coalition were delighted with this, yes?
Yeah, I mean, this is just—we're just restoring the status quo ante. This is how it's always been. I mean, to Jeff's earlier point, Title IX does not include gender identity. And this was, you know, emblematic of the entire Obama administration. What you can't get done through legislation, well, we'll just sign an executive order. And in this case, the pen and the phone giveth, and the pen and the phone taketh away. So we're just back to the way things have always been.
Let me ask you, if I could see if we could find a beginning ground where both you and Jeff agree, Dave, would you both acknowledge that high school is a place where in locker rooms, in bathrooms, in the cafeteria, wherever, teenagers are coming to grips with their own sexuality? And I guess the basic question here is, what is the role of the public schools, a public school, in helping them get through that?
The role of the public schools, Jim, is to protect the safety, security, and privacy of their students, male mm-hmm. and female, mm-hmm. and that does not mean compromising the safety and security and privacy of all these students, the vast mass majority of students, under the guise of addressing a transgender student.
So you would base this, yeah. Dave, you're suggesting that a transgender student poses a threat you said safety is an issue here.
Here's the thing, Bill. It's really not about transgender students. Because quite frankly, that's a rare situation. There, just to put it bluntly, there aren't that many, despite the prevalence in popular culture where you think there might be. They're not. Our concern is that when you talk about things like gender identity, it's subjective. It's what do you feel like and what do you feel like mm-hmm. today? And quite frankly, my concern is not for the, if you'll pardon me, legitimately transgender student, rare as they may be, but on the fact that any boy could say, I feel like a girl today.
Jeff,
I'm going to use the girls' locker room.
And this
is what we're concerned about. Jeff, it's really not about your issue. It's about, quite frankly, that any boy or any man, school, student in a school, adult in a public restroom, could go in, and that there would that this would eliminate just the common sensibility to say men use the men's locker room or bathroom,
and
women
use the women's. That's where we're just going to have to disagree. I mean, where we do agree. So Jim, your question was, where do we agree? We agree that students should be afforded a safe environment with which to go to school. And in fact, in the statement, the letter that the Trump administration had sent out about this, they did remind schools that they still have a responsibility to make sure that all students are treated safely and that there is a safe environment for them, including transgender students, including students that identify as gay, lesbian, and bisexual as well. So there is some common ground there about creating a safe space for students. We're talking about transgender students here. We are talking about students that do identify as a gender that is different from the gender that they were born with. We are not talking about boys dressing up as girls. We are not talking about girls dressing up as boys. We are not talking about the student that will decide to identify as male one day, female the next.
How do we know that, Jeff?
We don't have any cases of this happening. That's part of how we know this. We know that even though schools have been grappling with this for some time, there is not an increase in reports of assaults or public safety for students, for people taking advantage of protections for transgender students, just like in the municipalities in the states that fully protect transgender individuals from the time they're children up until adulthood with public accommodations laws. There is no uptick in public safety concerns
If I could jump in here, Jeff. Just over the last, say, maybe 12 months, I know of a couple instances in a couple of Metro Atlanta school systems where this has come up, and before this is kind of directed at both of you. I'm not seeing a whole lot of difference in before the letter of guidance and after the letter of guidance, because mostly David, you're right. I mean, these are relatively rare. I mean, not exceedingly rare, but relatively rare cases, enough so that each case that I know of has been negotiated kind of privately between the parents and the school administration as to what the proper thing to do is.
Well, and again, Jim, that's actually what the guidance says, is that it's accommodating the student.
And that would be an appropriate way to handle things. But our concern is, as I was saying earlier, if you just say anybody can use any bathroom, it's gone far beyond the needs of the transgender student, and it's just putting everybody in jeopardy. Washington State, you know, has transgender bathroom policies, and there were women who are survivors of sexual assault who were testifying before the commission, and it's just the threat of, just the worry about a man, any man. In all likelihood, a heterosexual man walking into the women's bathroom for the purpose or locker room for voyeuristic purposes. And this is what, you know, women in general are concerned about, and certainly women that have suffered sexual assaults are you know, just heightened sensitivity.
If I could just pursue that a little, do you acknowledge a kind of a sexual transgender people actually exist, that there is that status on the sexuality spectrum?
Of course, but I just don't think that it's nearly as common as one would be led to believe by a lot of references in popular culture.
And so the guidance itself, it did not mandate anything other than school systems needed to accommodate the wishes of the student. If the student wanted to use a gender-neutral restroom, the student has the right to use a gender-neutral restroom. If the student wants to use the restroom of his or her choice, they should be allowed to do that. So there is already a great deal of flexibility in there for parents, teachers, and students to work together to create a solution that works for the individual student.
Which included the threat of the loss of federal funding if schools did not go along with that so-called guidance.
Well, and that's what the courts will decide.
So the guidance was much more coercive than the word guidance would otherwise suggest.
Well, if we take Jeff's point and mention it one more time, if the White House suggested to schools they should pay close attention to Title IX and decide and realize they might be in violation of Title IX, what that tells us, as you said, Jeff, the courts are going to end up deciding this.
Absolutely. And that's where I would feel that the guidance was more of a warning, that that schools are opening themselves up to lawsuit if they are refusing to provide accommodations to that student.
Let me jump in, because I appreciate hearing this conversation. I want to raise it. I want to take it up to the 10,000-foot level, because I think at the 10,000-foot level, it'll be interesting to hear everybody talk about this from how our society is absorbing and dealing with new understandings about gender, sexuality, and that sort of thing. I, on this show, on several occasions when the White House issued this letter, said that I wondered if our country, having just gone through the fight over gay marriage and the length of time it took for Americans to come to terms, and I would argue in many ways become much more accepting of gay marriage today than they were, say, 5 years ago, 10 years. I asked on this show whether the White House made a smart decision to push the transgender issue, or if it wasn't, or whether or not society needed, in the same way it did with gay marriage, to walk through this in a more measured way and get a chance to understand. Because here we are coping with all of a sudden, oh, gay marriage, and now it's like transgender. And transgender was sort of thrown at people. I don't think we had much understanding of transgender until relatively recently. Am I making sense to either of you?
Yeah, Bill, I think that does make perfect sense. This is an issue that is new for a lot of folks. And I will certainly agree that for most people, they have never met someone who is transgender. Issues of gender identity is not something that people are used to thinking about. It is very different than sexual orientation. So each and every one of us has a sexual orientation. Each and every one of us has a gender identity. For most people, that gender identity is something that we were born with and that we live with for the rest of our lives. For transgender individuals, it is that same ingrained sense of who their gender identity is. It's just that it does not line up with the biology that they were born under. And that's where it's important to have compassion. It's important to have understanding. Dave, again, I'll agree with you that there's not going to be a flood of transgender students that are coming out because of the guidance, whether the guidance is there or the lack of guidance. What this is about is ensuring that schools are doing the right thing by those students who need accommodations when there is a transgender student. It's also about providing some strong guidance and understanding to schools so that they understand the limits of the law as well as the responsibilities under the law.
So go back up to the 10,000-foot level, Dave. Do you think that, for instance, do you and your organization, have you seen your members become more accepting, understanding of issues that involve the gay and lesbian community? And would transgender be a part of that learning process?
Well, Jim, I mean, first of all, I want to sort of, let's address the elephant in the room here. I mean, there's, the common perception is, oh, you're conservative or you're Christian, therefore you must be LGBT.
I asked that very openly.
No, but I mean, that's a perception that okay. Some people have, and in fact, I think that's
fair. I did not ask it with that in mind, though.
Yeah, but I mean, that's clearly not the case. I mean, at this point, most people, certainly in Metro Atlanta, know friends, families, coworkers that may be gay or lesbian. That's really not the issue, and for that matter, I don't go and poll the survey, but I'm sure among our members, among the people on my mailing list, I'm sure there are some gay and lesbian members. And the two are not mutually exclusive, that one can still be politically conservative, whatever one's sexual orientation. On the transgender issue, to your earlier point, Bill, I do think that, the Obama administration certainly pushed the envelope a little too far, that, you kind of reached the point where people said, wait a second, where is this happening? Where is this, tidal wave of transgender students that need accommodation and more to the point that everybody else has to alter what has just always been, normal operating procedure to accommodate.
All right. I am really got to get a break in. I want to continue this conversation, Jim, and I think the next step in this conversation is because President Trump, during the campaign, as you pointed out, Jim, had said he thought he could be open to transgender bathroom issue and all that, and now has changed his mind. I think it's going to it puts us in a position where we need to talk about whether this suggests anything more that might happen in terms of gay and lesbian issues under the Trump administration. But let's do that after we get in a break. It's 2:26 on Monday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and, well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway is with me. So is Dave Baker, the director of Georgia's Faith and Freedom Coalition, and Jeff Graham, the head of Georgia Equality. We're talking about the transgender order issued by President Trump last week, saying it was up to states, not the federal government, to decide on how transgender students in schools should use bathrooms. But I think we need to broaden that in a second here. But I do want to say, excuse me, we're getting a lot of tweets. Hania Whitfield says, everyone probably has met a transgender individual, just not aware. I apologize. I've got a catch in my throat. Thought Crime says, Title IX, if I choose to play on a sports team I gender identified with, then I can. Well, that's an interesting question. So a transgender student, what the question is, Jim, I think, is, can a transgender student play on the sports team of her or his choice?
I think we've had a couple instances where that's happened already.
Okay.
I think football over the weekend, a female who identifies as a male is on the local football team. I can't recall the state right now. It might be Texas.
Thought Crime also says too many fail biology. Biological sex is different from gender. A man can't say he's a cat or a girl willy-nilly. And Khalid says students undergo rigorous evaluation by docs and parental notification. Any boy can't just use girls' rooms on a whim, which is your point and one that you've expressed your concern about, Dave. So we're at Politics GPB. Keep tweeting us. So on a larger front, Jeff, President Trump was relatively empathetic about gay and lesbian issues during the campaign, but now he's turned around and seems to have made this ruling about transgender students with his conservative and with his Christian coalition supporters in mind. Does that give you pause about other issues relating to the LGBT community?
It certainly does. And again, it's not that the laws are changing. The laws have been there. Our understanding of the law continues to evolve and will continue to evolve. Again, the Supreme Court case that is coming up with the Gavin Grimm next month is going to be a very, very important Supreme Court case to watch. But in addition to Title IX that we've talked about for students, there is Title VII, which looks at sex discrimination in employment. And we have a landmark case, frankly, right here in Georgia. Vandy Beth Glenn, a woman who worked down at the Capitol several years ago, that when she transitioned on the job, she was fired for that. And her case was decided by the 11th District Court of Appeals, a very conservative court, three-judge panel. It took them, I believe they heard the case on a Thursday. They issued their ruling on Monday saying that Vandy Beth, as a transgender woman, was clearly covered under Title VII. And what was said to her and what was done to her crossed some very significant boundaries of how we treat people in the workplace. And so it does go beyond just the issues of Title IX and that simple guidance. It really is about where will this administration stand on enforcing Title VII, Title IX, providing clear, concise direction to states, municipalities, school systems that have questions about how far an expansive Title VII and Title IX are.
You want to jump in, Dave?
Yeah, well, once again, gender identity is not covered under Title VII. employment law. It's not covered under Title II public accommodation law. It's not covered under Title IX education law. And, you know, once again, it's a long, hard slog to change legislation. And advocates, you know, clearly can't do it legislatively. They've tried to do it, they try or are trying to do it in the courts, sometimes with success, sometimes not. But, you know, the shortcut, again, was the Obama administration guidance or executive orders and all that that just, you know, clearly are not standing.
David, if I could ask you, has anyone in your circle done any analysis of what the Supreme Court vote might be in this Virginia case that's coming up? I mean, we still got an 8-member court. Is that is there been any analysis done of whether this is going to result in another 4-4 split?
Jim, if you'd like to know the outcome of Supreme Court cases ahead of time, you need to get smarter guests than me.
Okay. All
and
right,
you should
Jeff.
Be playing the lottery if you can do that, Jim.
Right. Okay, I was going to say, that's good. That's right, real good.
But, Jeff, have you got any? What I'm leading up to is yeah. The question is if a 4-4 split, who got the last win in court? Was it the young?
We've not actually had an LGBT issue come before the Supreme Court outside of the marriage ruling back in 2015.
All right, so then let me move this to the state of Georgia, if I could, an issue that both of you have been involved with at the state capitol this year, and that's the a bill Democrats have introduced, which right from the beginning makes it problematic in a very, very heavily Republican legislature. But there's a civil rights bill that would extend the civil rights protections in the state of Georgia. We don't have a civil rights law statute in Georgia, but there are certain classes that are protected by federal law here, right, Jeff?
Correct.
Okay. This bill would, in fact, that federal bill now needs, according to the Democrats who've introduced it, what we need in the state is a bill that would extend those protections to the LGBT community. There are no protections, civil rights protections, in terms of jobs, in terms of any other areas of life in the state, right?
Employment, housing, public accommodations.
Right.
There is nothing on the federal level that clearly and explicitly protects gay and transgender folks from discrimination. Again, looking at the courts, more and more courts are saying that sex discrimination clearly does cover transgender individuals under gender identity. There is more limited case law, but there is some growing case law around sex stereotyping that provides some level of protection to folks based on sexual orientation. We would rather that be explicit in the law. Frankly, for years, with strong bipartisan support, we have tried to amend the State Fair Employment Practices Act to include sexual orientation and gender identity, which would protect state employees like Vandy Beth Glenn, and send a very clear signal to supervisors that they should not discriminate.
Dave, where does Faith and Freedom Coalition stand?
Okay,
on
I
this?
Want to make sure I kept up with the core changes there, because Bill, I think your question was about discrimination based on sexual orientation.
Yes.
And Jeff's answer kind of segued into transgender. And those are, quite frankly, two different things that we're talking about. And there are no examples of job discrimination, employment discrimination, public accommodations because of sexual orientation in this state. And for that, and because that is protected under federal law. You don't need a separate state law to add that as a protected class, because that discrimination does not exist in employment
why
and public accommodation.
Yeah, no. Sexual orientation is not explicitly covered under federal civil rights laws.
No, it's not. But I'm saying that there have not been cases of discrimination based on that.
Based on sexual orientation here in Georgia. You're saying that there have been no cases of that. I would love to introduce you to a woman that I know up in Blue Ridge. Her name is Connie Galloway. She actually worked for 28 years with a division of the state of Georgia. She had constantly received high praise, good marks. She had a coworker who had expressed concerns on numerous occasions that a lesbian should not, that she was not comfortable working with a lesbian in this division. That coworker became her supervisor, and one of the first things that supervisor did was fire Connie. Connie not only lost her job, she did not have. She looked for attorneys. Attorneys across the board told her that what happened to her was perfectly legal. And more than just losing her job, she was about 18 months short of being fully vested with the state pension. And so it is a decision that
cost her her job, which I think is an example of the exception that proves the rule. I mean, the point being that we all have, you know, gay and lesbian co-workers in all walks of life. And they're just treated like anybody else, by and large. I'm not saying that there might not be an exception here and there.
Just let me get Jim in here.
Okay. If I could, Dan, one of the arguments that we've had over the past 4 years on religious liberty legislation mm-hmm. has been the fact that we don't have in Georgia statute a civil rights. Any civil rights protections, which not only includes we're just not talking about LGBT or transgender, we're also talking religion and race here.
Right.
So, I mean, do we need a protection for some of those? Yeah, I mean, it's. I guess what I'm saying is, if we don't need the protection, if federal protection is good enough for the hiring, mm-hmm. then why do we need the RFRA bill on the state level?
You see, that's just the thing, because as far as protecting rights of gay or lesbian or transgender, federal civil rights do apply at the state level. The point is, on RFRA, though, you have a specific Supreme Court case that says RFRA is good law. The federal RFRA that passed the Congress unanimously in 1993. Passed the Congress unanimously, passed the Senate 97-3, signed into law mm-hmm. by President Bill Clinton. A 1997 case said that's still good law for claims or defenses involving the federal government. But if you want the same protections at the state level, you have to pass a state equivalent, which 31 states now have a state-level protection. And Georgia is in a minority of states nationally and the only state in the South to not have that state law.
It sounds like that would be an excellent argument for why you want a protection for LGBTs and a state civil rights law if you deal with civil rights as opposed to religious freedom.
Well, yeah, and that is exactly our interest in having this conversation around a broad civil rights law that protects everyone, that treats sexual orientation and gender identity evenly with religion.
Jim, I want to jump in.
Wait, I'm sorry. But you can't treat sexual orientation and gender identity equally with religion. Religion is a fundamental right. The First Amendment, it's not even, you know, we call it a constitutional right. It's not.
It's the First Amendment.
No, the First Amendment protects what is already an underlying fundamental right, that Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or prohibiting
Jeff,
the free exercise
thereof.
Jeff,
that strikes me as a profound statement that Dave just made about the difference between the protection that people have in terms of their religious practices and the practices of their sexual orientation.
Well, you know, certainly, Dave, you had asked me, you know, to provide some examples of people that had been discriminated against based upon their sexual orientation. When it comes to religion, there have been several cases that have been brought forward over the last 3 years. But in almost every single one of those cases, first of all, there was existing federal law, or there were some state equivalents that allowed lawsuits to go forward. And in most of the instances that we've heard about, the claimant that was arguing that they had been discriminated against because of their faith, they actually were victorious in court.
I've got to interrupt, because we're going to have to take a break in a minute. We're kind of running out of time for this discussion. I want to add one point, though. Jim, I want to turn to you on this. What's not been mentioned in this conversation, because we haven't been talking about legislators and how mm-hmm. they view legislation, is whether you're on Dave's side on this or Jeff's side on this, the legislature has made it clear over many years now, the Republicans who control the legislature, legislation which specifically names the LGBT, gays and lesbians, really has never had any chance of passing because, at least historically, the legislature has not wanted to codify and legitimize gays and lesbians. Is that a correct statement?
Right. That's correct. That's a correct statement. I mean, you. I don't want to go too far national, but you saw it in Cleveland this summer, where there was no mention of the acronym LGBT, but it's. I can't say the legislature, but what
Jim, excuse me. President Trump said that specifically in his acceptance speech.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. You're right. It was not in the
it was
platform.
Not in the platform.
But it was not in the platform.
All right. Look, this argument, this conversation is going to go on for quite a while. We're going to wait and see what the courts say about transgenders and Title IX. We're going to watch and see what happens in the state legislature in terms of civil rights protections. But I think at this point it's relatively safe to say it's
unlikely. I'd like to say thanks to both of you for showing up. I think this has been an interesting conversation.
Thank you. Dave Baker.
To be continued.
Dave Baker.
Definitely.
Georgia Faith and Freedom Coalition. Jeff Graham, Georgia Equality. Thank you both. We're going to take a quick break at 2:42 and come right back. Jim and I have a bunch of really interesting things to talk about.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with nature photographer Joel Sartore about his photo arc project, making beautiful studio portraits of animals in zoos and rescue centers. Animals like the Bengal slow loris, the white Arctic fox, and the snow mouse.
They're animals that will never have their voices heard before they go away, before they're let off to extinction.
Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Dave Baker and Jeff Graham making their way out of the studios now. I enjoyed hearing their conversation in the sense that it was a meaty discussion.
It was a meaty discussion, kind of absent the 15-second soundbites.
Yeah, and they're walking out together, too. I think that's always a good sign. Hey, big news out of the state capitol today. It appears that casino gambling is going nowhere. This session, let's listen to what the sponsor, Brandon Beach, told GPB.
You know, big issues like this take time. And so we're just going to have to come back next year. I'm going to go on a statewide tour when we get out of session and really try to create a grassroots effort to help folks tell their legislators around the state that this is a good thing for the state of Georgia.
I have to admit, Jim, I was a little bit relieved to hear it wasn't going to work this session, because I've been saying that for about 2 months now, that it was going to take several sessions. For a while there, I thought I was going to be proven wrong, which I so often am.
Well, no, just wait a minute. What we've got is, of course, we've got a Friday deadline for it to pass out of a bill to pass out of one chamber or the other. And then it's and I'm using air quotes here, then it's dead. But we have had zombie bills before.
Do you think that's going to happen here?
No, I don't think so. I think if Brandon Beach is already planning a statewide tour on this issue, then he's sincere about not bringing it back. But he was also the sponsor of a MARTA bill last year, which was declared formally dead, and I bought into that too. And it came back in kind of a half-life form. I don't think we're going to see that this year, though.
What forces came together to apparently defeat this bill so soundly?
Well, the religious conservatives, of course, although they have been on the ropes for the last several years now, they've kind of reached the high watermark of their influence. I think more than anything, what you've got is you've got a group of men in that Capitol who are running for governor in 2018. And the plan was to have the ballot issue on casino gambling on the ballot with their names.
So clearly the casino interests, who brought in armies of lobbyists on this thing, are not going away anytime
soon.
Well,
now we don't. Here's the thing. I mean, this popped up. Casino gambling popped up, what, 3 years ago, maybe, really in force last year. And what they did then was they had tried for several years down in Florida to get that passed. You'll recall that casino gaming even became an issue between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush at one point during the Republican primary. Over efforts Trump had made to put a casino in Florida, so that it's kind of a state by state thing, and until a better mark, if you will, jumps up, yeah, it's going to be our fight. But it could always go someplace else.
Interesting. Another subject that, in fact, you reported this in the Political Insider blog today. We've talked about Sally Yates quite a bit, the acting attorney general, fired from Georgia, Atlanta, fired by President Trump because she told her attorneys in DOJ not to take on cases that dealt with the president's travel ban, not to defend the travel ban. You've suggested that one of the reasons that she might not get involved in elective politics, so many Democrats want her to run for governor, but you've said that might be problematic because of things that could be happening with her in terms of the dealings.
Right. I mean, the way I phrased it this morning was she may be through with Washington. Washington may not be through with her.
So what's the development that's so interesting today?
Well, what we had is late last week, Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, sent a request to the Justice Department, now under Jeff Sessions' control. He and Grassley wants all of Sally Yates' emails until the moment she was fired, January 31st. And he has accused her of deliberately sabotaging that immigration ban.
So, Sally, so while they're going to be parallel, we're going to see perhaps Sally Yates have to be called in to testify. It's going to be interesting because she's going to be on two tracks. She could be called to testify in the hearings that will unfold over Russian involvement with Trump campaign and with the election because of her role as a deputy attorney general overseeing FBI, and at the same time be going down the hallway to testify herself and defend how she dealt with the travel ban.
And don't you dare think that those two aren't unrelated. Because what? But you're basically using one hearing, one investigation to impeach her testimony in the other.
That is going to be really interesting to watch play out. And you know what? It reminds me of again something we have talked about on this show. Sally Yates has not spoken publicly since she was released from her job. She hasn't talked to a single reporter. She hasn't done the kind of interviews you might expect other people would do. First, because of her nature, she's so circumspect, but also because I think she was smart enough to understand there were consequences to anything she said.
Right. Well, you're right. She has never been known as a blabbermouth.
Right.
She does not throw cases out there for self-aggrandizement. Clearly, she understands that she's going to have to be weighing her words very, very carefully because she's going to have to be testifying. And if that's the case, I just don't see how you mount a campaign for governor.
Yeah, I think that's right. Very quick note. We've been waiting to see whether Sonny Perdue, the nominee for Agriculture Secretary, is going to have hearings scheduled. Political Insider reported on that today as well. He hasn't finished his paperwork.
And quite frankly, there's a lot of paperwork that the FBI has to process in these cabinet positions, and they're behind. They didn't get. I think Sonny was nominated the day before Trump's inauguration on January 21st. So he was the final. I think
the day after.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's I wouldn't. It's nothing to worry about, I don't think, if you're Sonny Perdue. This is you've got a pretty much of a lock here. You've got enough Democrats on your side that you're not going to get blocked here.
We had a pro-Trump Spirit of America rally in downtown Atlanta over the weekend, while the Democrats were meeting to pick their party chair, actually.
And I wish I could tell
sorry,
you guys
it's today.
It's today.
I apologize.
What you did,
South Georgia.
You had one
Saturday.
over in Waycross, yeah. Just north of the Okefenokee
Swamp.
Sorry,
thank you for correcting. Yeah, at noon today, the Atlanta rally was supposed to take place down there right across from the state capitol. We haven't heard any reports yet about what kind of turnout they
have.
But we'll
not.
Be looking at that on Wednesday. But the point is that with all of these anti-Trump marches, protests, rallies going on around the country, the pro-Trump forces are now saying to their folks, you need to be out there too.
Right,
and this is a nationwide effort.
It's a nationwide effort, and right now I think it's concentrated in some very, very red states to get the movement going. And it's important in that if you're going to back up these Republican members of Congress as they take on the ACA or Obamacare, you're going to have to give them a little bit more support than we've been seeing in the town hall meetings, which have been hostile to the point that no one is having any, with the exception of Buddy Carter down in coastal Georgia.
Right. Okay. Jim, President Trump has a speech before a joint session tomorrow night. It's not considered a State of the Union. That doesn't come until after a president served in office for a year. This is time for him to get specific. He's got to say something about a plan for replacing the Affordable Care Act. He's got to talk about, he's going to tell us some details about his budget, which is going to be heavily oriented towards putting a lot more money into the military. He's going to have to tell us something about what agencies that money's coming away from. This is a speech that cannot be just a campaign speech.
And that's going to be a very, very tough temptation for him. He hasn't given that kind of speech yet.
Right.
Because, quite frankly, I don't think he's got his policy straight yet. I don't think you're going to see much of an emphasis on Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act because there is a very severe split within the Trump White House, not just within Congress on the House side, but within the White House over what to do with it. Of course, you've got the Vice President Mike Pence kind of siding with congressional Republicans, saying we need to repeal it and then replace it with our version, maybe not as good. But then you've got Steve Bannon, the White House policy political strategist for Trump. He's the one that is urging Trump to go slow on this.
Yeah, that is interesting, actually. The Washington Post, if you all haven't seen it, go to the Washington Post website. They had a really nice takeout on this, a full, very in-depth piece on the White House and its problems.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd point out is he's likely to emphasize is more money. I think a $54 billion increase in military spending, and what's interesting where he's taking it from. You know, the arts, of course, maybe the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, possibly, but the State Department. He's going after the State Department budget with Rex, and we haven't heard that much about
Rex. Maybe that's why he's got a lunch on the schedule with Rex Tillerson.
Yeah.
Just really briefly, because we're going to talk about this more when we get back into talking about Trump and media, which seems like it's going to be an ongoing conversation. So here's I want to propose something to you and you react. As the media has every good reason to continue to report stories, this is theoretical, that have to do with what appears to be the Trump administration efforts to undermine the credibility of the media and to raise questions in the public's mind about the legitimacy of a free press. Okay, my theory, that seems to be an important story to weigh in on. The more time that the media spends talking about the fact that President Trump is not going to that clubby White House correspondence dinner, the more the media itself undermines its own credibility.
Which is just, it's a silly fashion gig up in D.C. I don't know about you, I have never, ever, ever even been tempted to go, anybody would ever invite me. I just think what our job is to do our job. And the more instances you have where you have, for instance, I think it was, who was it, CNN who reported that the Secretary of Navy nominee was going to withdraw. The White House said, no, that's untruth. Then, of course, he withdraws. The more that happens, the more people understand what this is all about.
Yeah, I just think that the self-involvement of the media, I saw so many news organizations, when Trump tweeted, I'm not going to the correspondence dinner, made this their lead story. And I said, no, which it's just not important.
Look, there's plenty of narcissism in Washington to go around.
All right. Real quick, Lisa Clark, producer Lisa Clark, put together a great little montage of Jimmy Kimmel last night at the Oscars.
This broadcast is being watched live by millions of Americans and around the world in more than 225 countries that now hate us. And I think that is an amazing thing.
Maybe this is not a popular thing to say, but I want to say thank you to President Trump. I mean, remember last year when it seemed like the Oscars were racist?
We're at the Oscars, the Academy Awards. You're nominated. You got to come. Your families are nominated. Your friends, some of you will get to come up here on this stage tonight and give a speech that the President of the United States will tweet about in all caps during his 5 a.m. bowel movement tomorrow.
Jimmy Kimmel of the Academy Awards, he did not tweet about it. Great restraint by the president. Here's my question, Jim. This played really well in that room and certainly to the people who don't like Donald Trump. But this is another example that people who are Trump supporters, the middle of America, is going to run with and say the cultural elite, these are exactly the people we didn't want to have a say in how the country is run.
Right. And again, I think you saw the commercials that were very interesting. They were very much of an anti-Trump theme. Just like the Super Bowl a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I thought it was funny material. Kimmel had good writers on it. But I just wonder, you talked about Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You talk about the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm not going to talk about CPB because that's part of my work here. But National Endowment, if we get to a point where the arts and entertainment like Hollywood are considered elitist, they already are. And you're not going to find much support from middle America to keep funding going as long as people believe that elitists.
No, among Republican voters, and that's who Congress answers to for right now, for the moment, cutting the arts is fine with them.
Yeah, and by the way, unfortunately, the reality is that a great deal of the funding that the National Endowment does is to bring arts organizations that aren't seen by people in Trump territory, in small towns, in rural communities that don't have access to the arts. The National Endowment funds programs that take theater and concerts and artists of various stripes. So it's going to be interesting to see whether National Endowment is able to make an argument that they really do serve the Trump voters out there.
You know, you've got some Republican senators out there and members of Congress. I don't know who in Georgia might be a champion. Possibly Isaacson. I can't think. I don't think Perdue would be on that list.
All right. We're out of time. Jim Galloway, it's always... I kind of like these little sessions when we're through with a longer segment to be able to just sit and talk with you. You're a very smart guy, Galloway.
tell my wife that.
That's it.
Yeah.
We're out of here.
Yeah,
we're out of here on Political Rewind today. Thank you, Lisa Clark. Thank you, Tyler Morris. Thank you, Megan Moore, our intern, for your work on today's show. And thank you all for listening. Keep the conversation going at Politics GPB. We're back here on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. Among other things, we're going to look at the Trump immigration policy. They said there wouldn't be mass deportations, but there's more and more evidence that an awful lot of people are being detained, and we're going to talk about the consequences of that right here in Georgia as well as across the country. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll see you again Wednesday at 2 on Political Rewind.